Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, with the cost of employee salaries eating up city budgets, could a tax to help pay for public safety be the answer? And a new survey says that the majority of Californians would support a tax on soda. Plus, a new photo exhibit at Arte Americas, shedding light on the Valley's ag industry and the people who do the work. But first, for most cities, the cost of providing police and fire protection accounts for more than half of their general fund budgets. Cities strapped for cash are looking for new ways to help pay for public safety. The South Valley city of Visalia was among the first to ask citizens to pay for police and fire protection with a special tax. The hustle and bustle of downtown Visalia, a place alive with activity. Local residents point to it with pride. City Manager Steve Solomon says it has a lot to do with the community's vision for its city.
The city council in this city for decades and decades has been able to have a long-term view of what they thought this city should be and done things that were not necessarily going to have an immediate result for them, but would have a long-term result.
Solomon says the long-term planning not only included smart growth, but provisions for a strong police and fire department.
They were concerned about the gang problem. It wasn't, you know, a crisis, but they were concerned about it. They wanted to make sure we had good police response times. They wanted the city to be safe. They wanted the fire department to have good equipment, good response times, be located strategically throughout the city. And so that was their long-term goal.
The concern, how to make sure the city had the necessary funding to support public safety. Visalia, like other cities, have suffered through the state's continual budget crisis. Money meant for local governments was being diverted to state coffers. City officials estimate that over a 10-year period, California took more than $70 million from Visalia in property tax and other revenues.
They knew that there was a limit to how many police officers they could hire. Every year they would struggle with that.
So more than 10 years ago, city leaders, including the city council, looked at the possibility of a public safety tax. Back then, it would take more than putting an initiative on the ballot.
Nobody in the state had ever tried to do this for an ongoing operating revenue source.
Visalia had to get the approval of the state legislature to put a local tax initiative on the ballot. Legislators would only approve a quarter of a cent increase to the sales tax, and it needed a two-thirds vote to pass. After what was a very long process, Measure T made it to the ballot, and voters approved it in 2004.
I think it speaks highly to the Visalia community, and that we're willing to invest in our community and keep the tax dollars here locally. I think you saw that with the Measure T.
Danny Riston, battalion chief with the Visalia Fire Department, has been with the city for 21 years. He says police and fire settled the question of how the money would be divided early on.
That could have been a situation where police and fire really could have made it a difficult decision. But we worked cooperatively together. We looked back over sort of historically how our departments are funded, and we decided very early on that the police would get 60% and fire would get 40% of the Measure T monies. And we built our plans accordingly, and I don't think that we've ever looked back.
How Measure T funds would be spent was laid out in detail. For police, the department would hire an additional 28 officers over a 10-year period, open two new precinct offices, improve 911 emergency operations, and upgrade the dispatch center.
Currently, the city has the largest number of officers on the street it's ever seen its history. We have 60 full-time officers that are assigned to our policing districts.
Visalia Police Chief Colleen Mesta says having more patrols on the street allows her to free up other officers who can provide specialized services like a gang unit and prevention programs.
It was great that Visalia was the first city to achieve this sales tax override, and it allows for better management to be able to go after your specific problems.
Mesta says the department has improved its response times. And those on patrol, like Lieutenant Stephen Phillips, say they've seen other improvements.
Well, actually, over the last few years, crime has consistently been reduced. We've had some major inroads where our homicide rate is significantly down over the last few years.
Measure T has meant big changes for the city's fire department as well. Chief Riston says the funds not only made it possible to hire 15 additional firefighters, but improve service.
We have one unit set up, a chain of automatic, shutting it down.
We've bought two fire apparatus and part of a third fire apparatus with some of the Measure T money. We've built a state-of-the-art fire station and training facility in Northwest Visalia that's allowed us to not only improve our response time into that part of the community, but also allowed us to really have one of the best training centers in Central California.
City officials say the public safety tax has resulted in better planning. The quarter cent sales tax has remained at that level for 8 years and generates about $5 million a year. Money Visalia can depend on.
It's really helped us to, like I said, to be able to maintain and to grow because we knew that the money was coming.
Despite revenue from the safety tax, Visalia, like other cities, has seen its finances tested during the economic downturn. Over the past 4 years, revenue from sales and property taxes declined sharply, forcing Visalia to make painful budget cuts. City officials are optimistic, though. They believe they've seen the worst. Visalia was able to balance its budget this year.
We've got challenges just like everybody else, but the council's been willing to make some very tough decisions that, frankly, I think other cities maybe haven't made.
Measure T funds were not immune to the city's budget woes. Police and fire weren't able to add at least three positions. But Solomon says Visalia still has more officers than it would have had without the safety tax.
In the case of Visalia, obviously Measure T has helped us deal with the recession.
The added revenue makes a difference. The cost of police and fire can gobble up more than half of a city's general fund, leaving little money for other services citizens have come to expect. Fresno City Councilman Oliver Bain says it's a juggling act Fresno has dealt with for years.
The issue, in my opinion, really isn't just simply how much we pay employees or don't pay employees. What we have to be honest about is that the way our revenue stream works here in the city of Fresno, the general fund, we don't bring in enough revenue to provide all of the services that people are accustomed to in the fifth largest city in the state in the 21st century in California.
Baines is one city council member who believes it is time for Fresno to consider a public safety tax. He argues that since the city always places public safety as a top priority, the city needs to find a better way to pay for police and fire, services that now take up about 80% of Fresno's general fund.
A lot of cities are, and legislators are being honest with the public and saying the key priorities that we have as a city always revolve around public safety. And what they're asking is to say, hey, in the city of Fresno is no different. 80% of our general fund is obligated toward public safety. None of us has a problem with that, but it's difficult to pay for that and do other services as well. So what a lot of cities are turning to is a public safety tax.
Fresno City Manager Mark Scott says a public safety tax is worth consideration, but adds the city would need to convince voters that the tax is going to pay for increased services and not increased salaries.
And we need to be able to demonstrate that if we're doing that, we're doing that to provide the service levels that we used to have. We take burglary reports by phone now. I mean, I'm horrified that that's all that we can afford to do. So we wanted to get back to the levels of service we used to have.
Scott also says a lot of work still needs to be done with the unions representing city employees, specifically the Police Officers Association, whose agreement with the city can't be touched until 2015.
We need to satisfy the public that we're not going to ask for a public safety tax just to be able to pay people at levels that the San Joaquin Valley can't afford to pay. We've got to be able to show that. Otherwise, people will think they're being taxed for compensation as opposed to service. So if we can do that, if we can demonstrate that, then I think you've got something to talk about.
Unfortunately for the city manager, talk of a public safety tax will do little to help Fresno's current budget crisis, which has the city running out of cash by June and employees facing another round of layoffs. Now, as a way to generate badly needed revenue, the city of Fresno chose to outsource its solid waste division. The private company taking over commercial track pickup is paying the city a franchise fee. Fresno was anticipating the same deal with this residential trash service. The private company agreed to pay the city $2 million a year in franchise fees. Fresno would also get a $1 million signing bonus. That money was to start flowing to the city next month. The unions challenged the city's residential trash plan, won, and now it is going to the voters. That has left Fresno in a difficult place when it comes to its finances. And just last week, Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen announced the city would have to start laying off more city employees. Joining me now to further discuss Fresno's finances is Fresno City Manager Mark Scott. And we also have Bill McEwen, the editorial page editor for the Fresno Bee. Thank you both for being here today.
Morning, Juanita.
Mr. Scott, when you take a look at where we are with this latest development with the residential trash plan now probably going to voters, the city had a specific timeline when it comes to depending on those monies. What was that, and now what could we see?
We had assumed a March 4th start on the franchise, which would have meant that immediately we'd have received a $1.5 million cash inflow that was front-loaded on the contract, and then $200,000 a month from that point forward. So we're losing out on that for the period of time between now and when we have the election, and then if we don't win at the election, we lose it altogether. So pretty big hit.
What did that mean as far as the city's budget, the fact that you were depending on that money? When you say the city has a cash flow problem, what do you mean?
Well, we're in a situation right now that I really can't make payroll based on the revenues we expect to get from now until the end of the year. So I've got to cut, and I have to cut rather quickly. So we're in the process of figuring out what we can do to cover the loss of that revenue.
I'd like to ask both of you first, Bill, do you think the city or even the unions are prepared for the next step as far as what to come? Because I know when I talk to a lot of the union representatives and even the employees with the city, they all agreed. They didn't doubt that Fresno has a severe budget situation right now.
Well, that's marked this whole situation, because to me the reality is city workers do a good job on residential trash pickup. But the economic circumstances dictate that something must change. And this debate's been going on for quite a while. And I don't hear from the unions any potential solutions. It's a situation in which, we want to protect our jobs. And I understand that. I don't want to see anyone lose their job. In this case, they wouldn't lose their job, but they would take a substantial cut in salary and benefits. And so to me, that's what this debate is about. If city workers are going to continue to pick up the trash at people's homes, within the city limits of Fresno. What is their answer for this financial crisis? And they haven't come up with one. And Juanita, I want to point out something else, because you began this segment by talking about a safety tax, and Council Member Oliver Bain saying it's time for a safety tax in the city of Fresno. I'm one of the few people that I think seem to recognize that we already have a safety tax in the city of Fresno. It's not a sales tax. It's a property tax override. And when this property tax override was approved and it came on the heels of Proposition 13, there was a limited window of time in which such a tax could be imposed, and it was. This was said to solve Fresno's problems for a long, long time. So I would tell people in the city of Fresno, look on your Fresno County property tax bill. You are already paying a significant, and I mean significant, tax that is for the pension of the Fresno police officers and Fresno firefighters. And you could say, well, this doesn't fund operations. I beg to differ. When this was posed and passed and approved by the city council, it very clearly was stated, because the residents are paying this money, this will free up money to go into the general fund, and we will be able to hire X number of police officers, X number of firefighters. And in fact, those things happened, and it went even further with the police chief at the time, Max Downs, identifying new equipment that he would be buying because this money was freed up. And so, you know, I hate to say that I'm the only guy in Fresno with a long memory, but when I hear relative newcomers talk about, oh, we need a safety tax, I would say we already have a safety tax, but, and it's significant.
But when you say that, how many residents are even aware of that, or that that argument took place so long ago? And then when you mention the fact that the money's going for benefits, you know, I don't think either one of those agencies are going to raise their hand and say, look, we're already getting money that's supposed to be going for our benefits, because that is a point of contention already. And so, Mark, do you want to weigh in on that? I mean, is that the case? And if we were getting that money, what happened?
Well, Bill's exactly right. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at my budget in front of me, and in the general fund alone, we're looking at $13 million next year from the pension obligation bonds from the override, and it's more than that, because that doesn't count the other funds. We would be Stockton without this. I mean, I tell my employees, thank the public for this. This is something that was done years ago, probably even earlier than when Visalia did their tax, and without it, we'd be sunk. So Bill makes a good point. Our public's already pitched in for us.
Then what is the alternative? As Bill said, he didn't see the unions bringing forth that alternative plan.
Yeah, good ideas are few and far between, and this is what happens on the third or fourth year of a downturn, I suppose, is that you pretty much have done the things that are easy to do. We actually would have expected the residential solid waste issue to be easier. It's not simple for us, because we're dealing with valued employees and we're dealing with an important service, but I would not have seen quite this response coming. And I think people have asked for a vote, and we're going to recommend that the council approve that and put it on the ballot. So we're still very hopeful that we end up getting that revenue stream. Right now, we're looking at very bad cuts, and our police staffing has gone down and down and down over the years, the almost 3 years I've been here, and we're looking at dropping down to a point that is, we're looking at about 717 police officers at the end of this fiscal year, and last year when we did our budget, I was looking at 740 and shaking my head and saying, we cannot go below this number. But that's where we're going.
But one of the things I would like to point out, too, about Visalia, they're not saying that, oh, the public safety tax saved them. They did some other things as well, and that was, they're not paying for health benefits for retirees anymore. They right. made that decision. But here, do you think it was wise, now when we look back on it, to kind of build our budget all kind of based on assumptions? We assumed that the police officers union would or other employee unions would make some concessions. And we assumed that this trash deal was going to be okay, and we built that into the budget, and neither one of those things materialized. So, Bill, I'll start with you. What's the danger of doing something like that?
Well, I don't know that it's bad to assume that from the standpoint that you're going to put together a budget that you believe is reasonable, and you believe that you can negotiate some concessions. And, you know, there was no doubt about going forward on residential trash collection. And I can't speak for City Manager Scott, but, I would assume they had a backup plan. And the backup plan is not pretty. And so people that have kind of criticized this budget making process, I would say, well, would you rather have the police attrition begin at the start of the budget year and have gone from July 1st of last year without extra police officers, that kind of thing? I think in city governments today, you have to be very flexible and ready to make fast decisions, even though they're very painful. So I'm not really going to criticize the budget-making process in this case. You always have your best-case scenario. And the big difference today is, 6-7 years ago, if something came up, you could shake the cushions and find the nickels and quarters and make your way through. If you had a $1 million gap, you say, hey, we can find that. You sleep easy at night. But after everything's been squeezed the way it has today, when you have a gap, now you really are talking about layoffs as probably your only alternative.
Mr. Scott?
Can I jump in on that?
Yes, go right ahead.
That, of course, is exactly the case. We don't have the ability to lay off police officers because of these contracts that the city signed years ago. And the police union contract doesn't expire, as you said in your lead-in, until 2015. So we didn't have an option back in June when we were doing this year's budget of cutting police positions. We did, however, have the capacity to not fill positions as they come open, attrition of positions. And that's been going on all year. So Plan B, in part, has been going on all year long. As positions became vacant, we didn't fill them. What we had hoped was that we'd be able to stop that, that with the solid waste franchise fee, that we would be in a position we wouldn't have to keep going. Now we're actually looking at firefighters, and we're looking at every department in the city. I've got a meeting at noon today with department heads, and we're looking at every department, every function, to cut a little bit more than we think we ought to, but have no real choice. So, you know, around here, Plan B is always in effect, and we keep cutting and cutting. And probably far more than any other city in the valley other than Stockton. So we're doing what we can. But I think as far as budgeting at the start of the year, you make assumptions and you do your best to try to get them. But, you know, it takes, under our labor contracts, it takes agreement by everybody in order to get there, and we haven't.
Would you say some of this, and we already know, you know, we've discussed that some of the decisions, you know, that were made in the past weren't good for the city. But also looking at where we are with the contracts for the unions, is that part of the problem in trying to renegotiate? And then I would say also really having not just the workers, but the residents understand that when the city says, oh, we can no longer afford some of this, that they understand that what you're saying is built in truth. You really mean it, like this
right.
time. Because every year, you know, people got used to that with the state. Every year with these budget crises. And so I think it's really making people understand that you're not crying wolf.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, the hardest thing you do in government is trying to communicate clearly and credibly. You have to be very careful not to cry wolf, because people do come to believe that's what you're doing. We've held sessions where we invite the public to come in and go through the budget with us, and we'll get a good hearty 20 people that will show up for these. It's a tough thing to do in sound bites. It's a tough thing to do the way that we have to communicate day to day. But right now, I do believe most of our employees understand it's real, and I hope we can communicate that clearly to the public.
Bill, I mean, one of your things is communicating with the public. What do you see when it comes to just how as citizens view all this?
Well, you brought up state budget crisis and crying wolf, and the difference is at the state level, they can always patch it together by taking from the locals. And so a state has a lot more flexibility. In addition, states got a lot more capacity to borrow. So they can have a budget gap, and then they can cover it with smoke and mirrors, get to the next year and hope that things will get better. But when you're talking about city government, you're talking about the ground level, and you do not have that capacity to do that. You're less reliant on smoke and mirrors to patch over a budget, that kind of thing, because you're going to have to pay the bill at the end of the day. And, you know, this is not just about the salaries that policemen and firefighters are paid and their benefits and that kind of thing, because it's also about past decisions. And when you look at what the bond analysts say about the city of Fresno, they say this is a city without a lot of budget flexibility because it has high fixed debt. And a lot of this is, you know, the things that were made, the loans that were made, and those kinds of things. And now the Swearingen administration's, you know, trying to work their way through that. But anyone that doubts that the city's under a lot of financial stress needs to read the report by the National Credit Rating Agencies.
Right. Moody's did, you know, downgrade, you know, the budget rating again. And, Mark, I'm going to let you have maybe the last say on this because I know you got to go as well. But, I mean, that's what they even said about the city. We are paying for what we did in the past. And the people in office now are having to try to find a way to deal with that. And what does this say? I mean, what kind of warning can cities take from this? Because right now, like they said, we have fixed debt that we have to pay and you have no way around it.
Right. I it doesn't do me a lot of good to dwell on the past, but you do need to understand it. And we had very energetic and well-intended officials make decisions in the past trying to invest in Fresno and jumpstart different parts of the city. And a lot of those investments have turned out to be very challenging for us, to say the least, as we go forward. And we have to realize that Fresno is in a resource-poor part of the state. Our property values are low, so we get less property tax than other areas of the state. And our cost of living may be low, but it's not that much lower, so we don't make up that difference. We have to be very careful. We have to be careful not to assume that when housing starts occur, that the home building industry, as important as it is, we have to be careful not to assume that that drives our economy, because home building does not drive an economy. It doesn't build a sustainable economy. It reacts to an economy, but it doesn't build it. It doesn't provide the strength going forward that industrial development, for instance, does. So we have to be careful when we invest that we invest in the right things, and we have to be careful we don't start assuming a bright future before there really is one. And right now, because we haven't got anything to invest, we're certainly doing no damage to the future. But as the years go by, we have to be careful about the lessons we learn.
What is that debt on those bonds? What does that mean for Fresno?
Well, it's a fixed obligation that we can't do anything about outside of bankruptcy, which we're not looking at doing. And so it's, you know, when things go down and revenues go down, we're stuck with that amount of debt. It's 9% of the general fund, so it's not overwhelming like some communities have been in, but it's certainly something that we have to deal with. There are issues for, you know, the parking garage at the convention center that is 15,000 or 1,500 spaces, and on a good day might have 300 or 400 cars in it. On a bad day, less than that. We have built some facilities that are maybe going to be great in the future, but right now they're costing us a lot of money.
Okay. Well, good luck with what you have to do in your next meeting, and maybe we'll have you back to talk about that. Thanks for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Yeah, anytime. Thank you.
And Bill, you too. Always nice to have you. Appreciate your comments.
Thank you, Juanita.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. What we eat and drink has a huge impact on our health. Recently, a new field poll showed that a majority of California voters support taxing sugar-sweetened beverages. Those taxes are used for school nutrition and physical education programs. The survey also revealed that obesity prevention measures like this have greater support among ethnic voters. Here to discuss this issue with us is Viva Islas-Hooker, Regional Program Director, Central California Regional Obesity Prevention Program. And we also have Harold Goldstein, Executive Director of the California Center for Public Health Advocacy. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure.
I think what the survey kind of showed is that when we initially asked, or when they initially asked voters if they would support taxing sugary drinks, 53% of those voters stated that they would oppose such a tax. But when they were more specific and they asked if you would support a soda tax if the revenues would go to obesity prevention programs at schools, you had a larger majority, 68% stated that they would support the tax. So it seems to me that if you tell voters exactly what they're, where their tax dollars are going, and you're more specific, people are more apt to support something like that.
I think that's absolutely right, Juanita. You know, we're in a time of austerity and in a time where taxes have gotten a really bad name. But if people are clear about, in specific, this sugary sweetened beverage tax going to do things that prevent obesity, then there is a large support. And if you look closely at the information from Fresno, you see that in Fresno, a part of what this field poll also revealed is that not enough is happening around obesity and childhood obesity in particular. And so I think there's a lot of reasons for that. Having a community that's largely Latino, having a community that's so young with so many children under the age of 18 really creates the impetus for people saying, I'm willing to be taxed specifically if you use it for obesity prevention.
Now, Mr. Goldstein, your group has been very instrumental in the efforts to get soda and junk foods out of schools, also getting funding for school physical education programs. What did that take for you? Did you find the same thing? If you can let people know the benefits of these programs, what it's going for, you're more apt to build support?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And Veva is absolutely right that the problem of childhood obesity, especially in the Central Valley, is not going away. We released a study last year that showed that while childhood obesity rates in California have begun to drop, there in the Central Valley, the rates continue to climb. In Fresno County, childhood obesity rates between 2005 and 2010 went up by almost 5%. And so the people of Central Valley, Fresno in particular, where the field poll was done, by large numbers are supporting a policy change to help people make healthier choices. So as you said, while statewide, 68% of Californians are in support of a soda tax if the money goes to obesity prevention efforts. In Fresno, 80% of residents are in support of a soda tax. And absolutely, if people want to know where the money is going to go. And so healthier food programs in schools, more physical activity for kids, people are looking for answers. And it makes a lot of sense to focus on sugary drinks. It turns out that all the sugar in a sugary drink, one 20-ounce soda has 16 teaspoons of sugar. One 20-ounce soda has 16 teaspoons of sugar. It turns out all those sodas that we're drinking are responsible for almost half
you know, education really has been ramped up when it comes to obesity. We hear a lot about it. There's a lot of talk about it. But what I hear from both of you, and Veva, I'll have you go first, is that, and you mentioned, you don't think enough is being done here in the Central Valley.
Yeah, I'm a public health educator by training. And I think that in the public health field, we have spent quite a number of years just trying to educate people about what to eat and how to be physically active. And we've really neglected to look at how easy it is in our communities to eat better and move more. And so the type of things that are being supported by this field poll are things that change the environments that create healthy choices. Farmers markets, community gardens, having more spaces for physical activity, having access to clean drinking water, which is a challenge in many of our communities. Those things would go a long way in helping people to practice the healthy behaviors that prevent obesity and chronic diseases.
Mr. Goldstein?
That is absolutely right. What we need to do is to make the healthy choice the easy choice rather than the almost impossible choice that it is. And as you're saying, Juanita, there's been a lot of talk about childhood obesity over the last 10 years, and there have been some really good things that have been done, and Veva's group has been leading the charge there in the Central Valley. But there's still so much more that needs to be done. I mean, think over the last 10 years, how different is the world that we're living in? Is when you walk down the street, when you go to the store, does it seem different? Does it seem like there are more healthier options? Or is there just as many or more fast food outlets, larger and larger portion sizes of beverages, more and more sales on sugary drinks? You know, I go to the supermarket, and sometimes you get 2 for the price of 1 12-pack or 5 for the price of 2 12-packs. More than we realize, the food and beverage choices that we make are influenced by the world around us, all the sophisticated marketing and the ever-present availability of things like sugary sodas and sports drinks and juice drinks, all those things. We've allowed soda companies in particular to peddle all of their liquid candy without restraint to our kids in our communities. And, you know, it leads just to like an express line to obesity and diabetes.
I think most people would agree it is easier and it is cheaper to have access to and to buy foods that aren't necessarily good for you. And for a long time, especially in minority communities, there some communities didn't even have a supermarket with fresh produce. And so people really didn't have all those choices that they have. So I know a lot of people would say as easy as, well, just choosing, just make a choice. But you really have to look at sometimes, especially in this economic climate, what you have available to you.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I think that the idea of choice is false when the healthy option isn't there. You know, when you walk into a lot of the convenience stores that exist in low-income communities, it's a choice of chips, or more chips, or, you know, soda. And you couple that with what Harold mentioned is this sort of marketing of the unhealthy, telling you that if you drink this or eat that, you're faster, you're sexier, you're skinnier, you're happier. It becomes really confusing. And so I think what we need to make sure happens is that everybody has access to the healthy. Let's make the healthy the most affordable, the most ubiquitous, the thing you can get by default. And so looking at how we use revenue like from a tax to help ensure that we create those type of environments is important for us, and it's important for our children.
Now, it was pointed out in these studies that both African Americans and Hispanics strongly supported obesity prevention measures like taxing or removing them from schools. And I think you could probably argue successfully because in their communities, that's what they have to deal with.
Yeah, and they're suffering the butt of the chronic illnesses. You know, when you look at statistics that are showing that half of all Latino children born today will develop diabetes in their lifetime, that's frightening. It's appalling. We shouldn't let that happen. And, you know, these rates of obesity are alarming in the African-American community, like the Latino community, but they're also affecting our Southeast Asian communities and really communities who are living in poverty because of the limited healthy choices and because these communities communities are making choices that are based on their economic availability versus what sound nutrition would be. So if we could make the healthy food the cheapest, the most affordable, I think that we could go a long way to helping people practice healthier diets.
And I know you wanted to say something, Mr. Goldstein.
Well, I think far too often the question about obesity and diabetes is posed as, is it a matter of personal responsibility or a matter of community responsibility? And what this field poll shows is that in the Central Valley, people think it's both. People want to take personal responsibility and make healthier choices, but they also want their communities to be designed in ways, like Vev is saying, so that the healthy choice is the easy choice, is the default choice, that it doesn't have to be a Herculean task to find healthier options.
Well, you know, let's take for example, because when you talk about the public and the public's perceptions, and when people say folks need to take responsibility, because when you hear, like, for example, what the mayor wanted to do in New York when it came to banning those huge sodas, people are like, well, you know, that's my choice. If I want to go buy or get a huge soda, you know, that should be my choice. But in some cases, what you all are saying is that in some communities, they don't have a real good choice.
That's right. I mean, I think that, you know, this is not as sort of black and white as either you can have all the soda you want or not. I think it's a matter of the fact that the healthy options sometimes is so hard to get. And I'll give you an example. In the San Joaquin Valley, we have the majority of communities that have water violations. They do not have potable water coming out of their faucet. And so in those places, they're paying for water that they can't drink. They're having to go out and purchase water. And water is much more expensive than sugary drinks. So what happens is that many times these low-income families, just because of sheer economics, they're buying sugary sweetened beverages because that's what they can afford. And so I would say that those people don't have choice, that's an absence of choice. And so what we really want to get to is the place where everybody in the San Joaquin Valley should have access to cool, clean, fresh, abundant water. They should have access to the fruits and vegetables that are grown in their backyard on a regular daily basis, and not just, you know, on an occasion when they can't afford to have the healthy meal. That should be the default, that you should be able to eat well and move more and have a healthy lifestyle.
But for that to happen, as you mentioned, there has to be, you don't want to make policy for everything. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to something as basic as clean drinking water, and that a lot of people do not have that, and when it comes to something as basic, here we are in the valley where we grow all of this fresh produce, having access to that. I'm sure anybody will tell you, I don't care what your income level, when you go to the grocery store, buying fresh produce and fruits cost a lot.
It does. And I think it's that way for a variety of factors. You know, all of our fresh produce that's grown here is trucked out and then it's trucked back in. So there's costs then that are put on top of that that increase the price of it. So we need to create the markets where our locally grown fruits and vegetables is sold directly here, and to help mitigate some of those additional charges that go on to the cost of it. There's a lot, I think, that we can do. It doesn't necessitate policy or legislation to change. It's really organizational and system practices that we need to affect also.
Okay, when we talk about, let's talk about solutions, Mr. Goldstein, as what she was saying. There are things that we can do here locally. What can we do? I mean, it seems to me that there would be some kind of a solution. We have talked about the obesity problem. We've talked about the health issues so many people have, especially here in the Central Valley. What do we do to change this?
Well, I think there's a lot that we can do. And I think in addition to the obesity epidemic, I think we need to underscore the diabetes epidemic for people in your audience to think about how many people do they know with diabetes. That number is going to continue to increase. As Veva said, children born in the year 2000, of those children, it's expected that half of Latino children born that year will have diabetes sometime in their lives. This is going to be and continue to be a devastating epidemic. And there's a lot that we can do. I want to put a push for policy change, because in a democracy, the way we come together to decide what kinds of communities we want to have, what kind of environment we want our families and our kids to live in is by changing public policy. And so 10 years ago or so, Veva and organizations like hers and ours came together and said, let's get soda and junk food out of schools. And as a result of that, I think the evidence is now starting to be clear that childhood obesity rates have started going down. So there's a lot that we can do in our communities. I think that we can have zoning ordinances to limit the amount of fast food in our communities. We can mandate that fresh, good-tasting water is available in drinking fountains in public places. We need to make sure, as Veva was describing, that every household in this state has safe drinking water. There's a lot that we can do. Veva, what else do you think is most important?
I was going to say on the local level,
yeah,
what do you see?
Yeah. Well, I would say one thing is that I think consumers, as this field poll results indicated, is that they do very well know the connection between sugary sweetened beverages and obesity. And so I would celebrate that as a success and a step in the right direction in terms of a solution, because once people are informed, and as this is also revealing, they're willing to then make the change to drive resources to those things that they do see as solutions. And so getting more locally grown fruits and vegetables into our local stores, store siting. We have a number of community residents that are living in neighborhoods or small rural communities that don't have access to a full service grocery store. There are intermediate measures that are solutions. We've been very successful at getting farmers markets established, driving more of the local produce into neighborhoods and communities that don't have it. Ensuring that these farmers markets accept CalFresh, which is food stamps, as well as EBT, so our low-income residents can avail themselves to purchasing. We've had a number of interventions that are around unlocking school gates so that families have a safe place to be physically active, in particular in neighborhoods where there are no parks or there are very limited park space. We've been doing a tremendous amount of work at educating parents so that they can get involved in school wellness committees, so that they can get involved in planning public participation decisions that are happening in their community, how their streets are designed, where parks are sited, where stores are sited. All of these amenities that many more affluent communities have, we want to see that available to everyone so that, again, they have the opportunity to practice the healthy lifestyles that keep them healthy now and in the future, as well as their families.
Okay. Juanita, if there's one thing that people could do, it would be to stop drinking all those sugary drinks. Soda and all those sugary drinks are the leading contributors to obesity. They are harmful to people's health. They cause obesity. They cause diabetes. And we need to start limiting the availability, especially in public places. There is no reason why cities and county and the state are doing the bidding of the beverage industry and selling kids sugary drinks.
Okay, well, we will end on that. Veva Eisles-Hooker, Regional Program Director, Central California Regional Obesity Prevention Program, and Mr. Harold Goldstein, Executive Producer of the California Center for Public Health Advocacy. Thank you both this morning for this discussion. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Well, Valley of Shadows and Dreams is a new black and white photo exhibit at Arte Americas in Fresno. Ken and Melanie Light spent years capturing the harsh truths of farm workers' daily experiences here in the Central Valley. And the photographs and words tell their story. We are pleased to have Melanie Light with us. Also, Frank Delgado, Program Director of Arte Americas. Thank you both for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Juanita.
Thank you, Juanita. And we also have Ken Light on the line as well.
Oh, okay.
Today, if you like.
Well, I'm glad you're there, Ken, because I do have some questions for you starting off with. I understand this was a five-year project. First of all, what made you two choose this particular subject, and what did it take over this five-year period to get these photographs? Because I've seen them, and they're very haunting. Go ahead.
Well, the inspiration was really Melanie, who came to me, and maybe she'll talk a little bit about that.
Well, it was very simple. I was doing some research down in Visalia for another project, and I just was driving, and really, honestly, it's embarrassing to say, but it was really the first time in my life I ever looked when I was driving through the valley, and I saw that they're putting in these giant developments smack dab in the middle of prime agricultural land, and I just came back scratching my head like, can they do that? How can that happen? And so we just started this big journey to discover the valley, and it was an amazing journey. We learned so much, so much.
And the journey really started before the downturn, so we were there at the prime of the building of the houses, and then, of course, the downturn hit, and there was the drought and immigration marches, and it just kind of spiraled into this just amazing, amazing global story, really, because it's the same issues that face other communities all over the world.
Because when you a five-year period does give you the opportunity to really examine what you saw and what was going on. Tell me about the families, the farm workers, the people that you came across when it came to getting these amazing photographs.
Well, part of it, I think, for both of us, both for Melanie from the interviewing standpoint and me from the photographs, people don't feel like they have a voice. And so when you go out into a field or into someone's home or you work with community organizers, people are just wanting to just tell their stories. They're wanting to be heard because a lot of the mainstream media is really not covering these kind of stories and really looking in depth. And so people just were so generous with their time and patient with us because for us, it was really a learning curve, just hearing stories and following those leads to meet other people and to see other things and to understand really from an outsider perspective what are the major issues that are in the valley that affect all Californians.
And, you know, when you talk about, you know, farm workers, ag is such a huge part of the Central Valley, but there are people who can go their entire lives here and not really see a farm worker community.
Exactly. It's really hidden, and yet it's so powerful. I mean, it provides half the food in this country and abroad. You know, it's incredible, and the growers are shaping the quality of our lives, even those of us who live on the coast, and yet we aren't really able to see the upfront, you know, front lines action of it. So it was an eye opener to me as I'm sure it will be to many people also in the valley.
And for you, Melanie, I know you put the words to the pictures. So did you have a chance to sit down and talk to the people who were the subject of your photographs?
Oh, yeah. I interviewed a lot of people. I probably interviewed around 50 people, and it spanned a whole range of folks from, you know, undocumented workers to growers to city planners. I interviewed an agricultural loan officer, just all kinds of people, just to get an idea of how everything is put together in the valley, how the, you know, the economics, the social stuff, and the environmental stuff are all interacting and working. So it was a big project, and it was a real luxury to have, you know, time to explore all these different curlicues of ideas and thoughts.
Now, Frank Delgado, Program Director with Arte Americas, tell me about this exhibit as far as the museum and being able to host the exhibit, and what are some of the activities planned around the exhibit?
Well, the Valley of Shadows and Dreams photographic exhibit is part of a trio of exhibits that we are currently showing. It is part of and under the umbrella of the Green Art Project, a project that we have with the Fresno Art Museum and Fresno State's Center for Creativity and the Arts. So between the three of us, we are all presenting artwork that is eco-aware, environmental art. And so in the way that these photographs represent disappearing farmland, we have also combined them with two other exhibits. One is titled Ignite, the Art of Sustainability. Artists from the UC Davis area who have all applied their artistic skills to highlight various aspects of whether it may be pollution or non-native plants to various areas of the state of California. But the third largest component that we have is called Nothing Wasted, which is a group show that has been very, very compelling to everybody who's come in to view it. Nothing Wasted is a group show that features art professors. It features students who are earning their master's degrees right now. It features veteran artists who are very well known in this area. And we've combined them all, and they have all used disposed media. So there are people who are normally painters who are creating sculptures out of pieces of metal. That this one particular artist created a pterodactyl, a heron, a huge heron out of pieces of metal that he's picked up as he's gone to take his dog out for a walk in the mornings. And he's combined them together to create this piece of this metal sculpture that is very, very compelling. There's other pieces of artwork that are of disposed metal and wood that have been all combined. But the ultimate story here is that all of these items would have ended up in a landfill, have been repurposed, and it, for the ultimate sake of promoting waste reduction, talking about sustainability, creating the discussion, and creating a new life for the disposed media.
And how long is these exhibits going to be up?
The exhibit will be showing until April the 7th. And for the listeners who have not visited Arte Americas, we are in downtown Fresno's Cultural Arts District. And we are open 5 days a week from Wednesday through Sunday. Our parking and our admission are all sponsored and free, so there are no meters. And we do invite people to bring their children and for people to who have an interest in the environmental issues to come and take a look, because there are a lot of discussions that really are spawned from viewing this exhibit.
It sounds like a great exhibit. Not only that, a learning experience. And for those of you who have the opportunity, I know Ken and Melanie Light, they have a website up so you can see some of what they're talking about. But it would be great to see these pictures in a museum setting.
And Ken and Melanie will be here this Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m., and they will be having their artist reception at Arte Americas.
Okay, this Sunday?
From 2 to 4, yeah, they'll be here. You can meet them and talk to them personally.
Okay, that sounds great.
Signing books and talking, and our website is valleyofshadowsanddreams.com.
Okay, well, thank you all. This sounds like a great exhibit, something great for Fresno. And Ken and Melanie Light will be here on Sunday, so that's a great opportunity for you all to meet and talk to them. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Anita.
It's been a great discussion. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Anita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.